There has been, for quite a long time now, a continuing concern about whether some aspect of vaccination might have some tie to autism or to some disorders along the autism spectrum. It started, I think, with a concern about the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. It morphed into a concern about thimerosal, which is a mercury derivative that used to be used in many vaccines, is still used in some, including some flu vaccines, as a preservative. And most recently, the main concern has been about too many vaccines in too concentrated a time period. The sense that it might be a dangerous shock to the nervous system of some children to get, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 vaccines on the same afternoon, which happens sometimes, especially if you know, your child's been sick and missed a few vaccines, and then you get your kid to the doctor's office and the doctor tries to catch up with the schedule. So the concern about autism has morphed in terms of what about vaccination might cause autism. Among the things that are interesting is how irritated public health gets that the critics keep changing their grounds, as if that weren't good science. They started out worried about MMR because Andrew Wakefield in the UK did a study that seemed to show that the MMR vaccine was the problem. So people focused on that. Increasingly, Wakefield was proved wrong, and not just wrong, but dishonest in his study. So a lot of vaccination critics moved from focusing on the MMR to focusing on thimerosal. And public health said, well, make up your mind. What are you worried about? As if there was something wrong with abandoning a disproved hypothesis and going on to a different hypothesis that might be more likely to prove true. I thought that irritation was very revealing. The evidence on thimerosal is increasingly strong that thimerosal isn't a cause, or at least isn't a significant cause of autism. I mean, among other things, we've gotten rid of most of the thimerosal in most vaccines without seeing any significant improvement in the autism picture. And now the concern is about multiple vaccination. There's much less evidence either way about multiple vaccination. It's not as if it were proved that multiple vaccination causes autism, but it hasn't been as definitively disproved as the two earlier hypotheses have been. So that tends to be where the dialogue is now. One of the things that I think is fascinating here is, you know, imagine that Andrew Wakefield had been right, and that the MMR vaccine was a significant cause of autism. So we would have abandoned the MMR. We would have started, returned to giving the measles vaccine, the mumps vaccine, and the rubella vaccine separately rather than all together. It would have been a fairly minor change, and we would have made a major improvement in autism. We would have eliminated one of the major causes of autism. It would have been wonderful if Wakefield had been right. Okay. Unfortunately, Wakefield was wrong. But one of the things I find absolutely stunning is that whenever public health people talk about Wakefield having been wrong, they don't sound disappointed that he was wrong. They sound triumphant that he was wrong. They're delighted that he was wrong. Because their defense of vaccination is that much stronger. Because Wakefield was wrong, they don't have to live with, the MMR vaccine having been a health problem. But what kind of public health professional would be more interested in being proved right than in making progress against autism? They are right. It isn't progress against autism to abandon the MMR. But why are they so pleased at that? Do you understand what I'm talking about? I mean, it's to me stunning that public health as a profession, most vaccination experts, are much more deeply committed to vaccination being benign than to identifying and solving health problems that might be attributable to vaccination. And if you're the parent of an autistic child, you're much better able to learn that autism is not caused by the MMR if you learn it from someone who joins you in wishing that, you know, that had been true, because then you'd have solved the problem, you'd have known the cause, rather than someone who's delighted not to have a clue what causes autism. I mean, it's humanly understandable that if you were a vaccination proponent and you were actively giving people the MMR vaccine, and along comes Andrew Wakefield with a very preliminary study that seems to suggest the MMR vaccine might be dangerous, might be causing autism. You know, you hope he's wrong. You'd rather not think that, you know, the vaccine you've been giving your patients and recommending to other docs is in fact a health catastrophe. You hope he's wrong, but you certainly want to know if he's right. So if you have any kind of honor at all, and public health people are honorable people, you do the research. And they did the research, and they found out he was wrong. And I can understand humanly why they were relieved to find out he was wrong, rather than disappointed to find out he was wrong. But they need to understand that patients are disappointed that he was wrong, because it leaves autism a mystery, rather than a solved mystery. It leaves it an unsolved mystery. But I think it's in some ways more important than that. Let's take it out of the public health context. You're a company emitting various pollutants out your smokestacks, and along comes a study that says your pollutants give people cancer. So you do your own study and establish to your satisfaction that what's going out your smokestacks doesn't give people cancer, and you tell them so, and you expect them to believe you. Well, they're not going to believe you. You know, it's your smokestack. The fox is guarding the chicken coop. That's what happened with these MMR studies. Virtually all the research since Wakefield's research has been done unilaterally by vaccination supporters. Now, I don't actually think Wakefield was right. I think Wakefield was wrong. But you have to look at the evidence that Wakefield was wrong through the lens of who did the research. And it was all done by people who very much wanted him to be wrong. And it's not as if they reached out to vaccination critics and said, come do this research with us. You know, let's do this research jointly. Let's supervise this research jointly so that we can't cheat and you can't think we're cheating. There's a lot of understanding in other arms of medicine research either has to be double blind, or it has to be done collaboratively with critics, that, you know, nobody's going to trust, you know, your research on the efficacy or safety of your product. But public health sees itself as so obviously good guys, that the normal rules of conflict of interest don't apply. It's not that I think Wakefield was right. I just think the evidence that Wakefield was wrong would be enormously stronger if that research had been done in ways that were accountable to the critics of vaccination. There is a lot of research on the relationship between the preferences of the people who do a study or the people who fund a study and the findings of that study. And a lot of that research is medical. The main thrust of the research, again and again and again and again, is that studies almost always find things that the person funding the study or the organization funding the study was happy to see found. I'll give you a very concrete example. I have a client now that's the manufacturer of a particular birth control pill. And there were two fairly sloppy, not horrible, but, you know, preliminary, not too reliable studies done that indicated that particular birth control pill might be more dangerous in a particular way than other birth control pills. And those studies were published and should have been published. I mean, they revealed a possible problem. So my client, you know, was very worried about, you know, could this be true? And they did a much better study, bigger sample, more careful matching, more rigorous statistical analysis. And they found that the problem wasn't there. All right, so now, you know, you're the FDA, or you're just a woman trying to decide what birth control pill to use, and there are two studies done by independent people with no axe to grind, but they're pretty small scale, cheap studies, and they found a problem. And then there's one study, which was a much more rigorous study, but it was funded by the organization, by the company that makes the birth control pill they were studying, and they found no problem. Which one are you going to trust? You know, well, the evidence says you're better off trusting the sloppy studies done by a third party than the rigorous studies done by an interested party, because the social science of science studies on the relationship between the preferences of the people doing the study and the findings of the study have found again and again and again that there's a Ouija board phenomenon at work. Without being consciously dishonest, without being intentionally dishonest, somehow, and how you frame your study, how you do your methodology, somehow, even in peer-reviewed studies, you know, most studies wind up finding different things if they're funded by one side in a controversy than if they're funded by the other side in a controversy. That's science, too. You know, so if you insist that science says my study is good even though I have a vested interest, then you're ignoring the science that says your vested interest is extremely likely to have contaminated your study. Yeah, no. If the only way to have a decent control in a study is to treat people in ways that are medically unethical, you can't do the study. And then you look for second best. Double blind is the gold standard, but there are silver standards and brass standards. It's not a choice between the gold standard and give up on doing research at all. And I am a big believer. In situations where you can't do a study that is, universally agreed to be reliable, then what you do is you balance the biases of the people doing the study by doing a study collaboratively with your opponents. So what I said to my client that manufactures a birth control pill that's under attack, and they did a study that found the pill is safe, and other folks did a study that found the pill is dangerous, as I said, all right, what you need to do is fund a methodologically excellent study, okay, but get it done by people who are critical of you, who are on the other side. Get them working with you and create a situation where you have signed off on advance. You have signed off in advance that if this study comes out showing your pill is dangerous, it's a good study, and you're stuck with the result. They have signed off in advance that if the study comes out showing the pill isn't dangerous, it's a good study. They're stuck with the result. And I have done this, a bunch of times with clients on a bunch of different issues. Where a company reaches out to an activist group and says, all right, let's do this study jointly. We're trying to find out if we have contaminated the groundwater. You're not going to believe it if we do the study alone, and you're right not to believe it. You're not going to believe it if we hire a consultant to do the study alone, because, if we're funding the study, the consultant knows what side their bread is buttered on. They're likely to, unconsciously produce a study that pleases their client. So let's do it jointly. Let's supervise it jointly. Let's choose the contractor jointly. Let's do all the work jointly so that neither of us can cheat and neither of us later can claim the other one is cheating. That's doable. It's not easy, but it's doable. I think it's very rare in the public health field. It's quite common in other fields, quite common in the environmental field. But it's very rare for public health professionals to reach out to their critics and say, why don't you sit on the oversight team that's managing this study? We're trying to find out whether people are likelier to get autism if they have a whole lot of vaccines, a whole lot of vaccinations in a short period of time. We're going to do a study on that. Why don't you sit on the team that helps plan that study and helps supervise that study? That's rare. It would help enormously. Yeah, I think it's true that little by little public health is realizing that research that isn't accountable to your critics isn't useful I mean, particularly if you're studying a question you already know the answer to. I mean, if you're actually trying to find out the answer, then even if nobody believes it except you, at least you've found out the answer. But if you're doing the research in order to prove it to your critics, it's kind of silly to do it in a way that your critics are not going to buy. And I think I think public health is beginning to get that, and more willing than it used to be to reach out, if not to the hardcore critics, at least to to skeptics, to neutrals, to people who are not part of the vaccination establishment. So there's progress there, and of course, when they start being more willing to reach out, they come up against resistance on the other side. If you're a vaccination critic, and your choice is to stay on the outside and take pot shots at all the research they do, or come in and be stuck with the result. You may well decide that it's smarter to stay on the outside. Once the public health establishment decides, all right, I'm willing to work with critics, it's a tough sell to persuade the critics. But even if they fail visibly, if that entire process is transparent. If public health is going on to the critics' websites with invitations to come work with us, and the critics are saying no, we're not going to do that, then public health is saying yeah, but that's not fair. You don't believe it when we do the study alone, and we understand that you're right not to believe it when we do the study alone. So we want you with us and working on the study, and if we cheat, you can catch us. And if we design a methodology that's not fair to your position, you guys are smart. You'll know that in advance, and you can criticize that methodology in real time. And you have that dialogue. You can get to the point where it's awfully embarrassing for the critics not to be willing to work with you. My sense is very often when public health finally wraps its mind around reaching out to critics, they reach out in a kind of half-hearted way. And the critics say, no, we don't want to work with you. And public health breathes a sigh of relief and says, all right, thank God. We invited them and they said no. Now we can go back to doing unilateral studies. You got to take that goal seriously. You got to really want to get them in. And you've got to make it more damaging to their cause to be seen to be, you're calling their bluff. They have been complaining that that you're doing research unilaterally and you can't be trusted. You're calling their bluff by inviting them in. You have to call their bluff in a very transparent way, a very visible way. You have to bend over backwards to make it clear that you are newly willing to give them a genuinely powerful role in making sure this research isn't unfair to this position. To their position, and if they're unwilling to take on that powerful role, then parents and skeptics and neutrals and journalists, are going to learn something important from that. Let's start with flu, and I want to be really clear. Everything I'm saying about flu, I learned from public health, so it's not like these are secrets. This is information that is readily available, but is de-emphasized by public health, because it's information that might get in the way of public health's goal of getting as many people as possible to get vaccinated against flu every year. Right. So let's start with the fact that there are lots of different kinds of flu, and they wax and wane and they mutate. So the flus that are prevalent in one year are likely to be somewhat different from the flus that were prevalent the year before. And because of that, every year, public health takes its best shot. They guess which strains of flu are likeliest to be prevalent next year, because it takes them nearly a year to develop the vaccine. So long in advance, many months in advance, looking at the trends that they see in which flus are prevalent now, they decide which flus they're going to develop antibodies against for next year's vaccine. Okay, and that's why they tell you have to get vaccinated every year against the flu. Except some years, this year's guess is the same as last year's guess. Some years it looks to them like flu hasn't changed very much since the previous year. And it's going to be pretty much the same vaccine as last year. They don't tell you that because if that's true, probably you have enough antibodies left if you were vaccinated last year that you can skip this year. But they don't want you to skip this year. They don't want that dose of vaccine to go unsold. They don't want you to get out of the habit of getting vaccinated every year. So what they say is you need a vaccine. You need to be vaccinated newly every year against the flu. And if there's a year when it's the same as it was the previous year, they don't tell you. Other times, they just guessed wrong. It isn't the same as last year, but it also isn't the same as what's in this year's vaccine. There's not a good match between the vaccine, the flu strains that they've decided to put in the vaccine 8 or 9 months ago, and the flu strains that turn out to be circulating. So the vaccine is not as effective as it would otherwise be. They don't tell you that either, because they don't want to say it's a crappy vaccine this year. We guessed wrong because that would deter some people from getting vaccinated. And again, it's not as if that information is secret. It's not secret, but you don't see news releases about it coming out from CDC. You don't see it as one of the bullet points in the get your vaccine messaging that, you know, sorry to tell you that this year it's a bad match for the influenza B. Or sorry to tell you this year, you know, one of the three is a bad match, or two of the three are a bad match, you know, or it's the same as last year. So if you got vaccinated last year, you might not need to bother. These are things they don't tell you. Now, even when it's a good match, okay, the flu vaccine is 70 to 90% effective in healthy adults. Now, they don't hide that either. And to be fair, sometimes they even say it explicitly, but not usually. By and large, most local public health departments consciously give the impression that the flu vaccine is almost 100% effective. When people say, I got the vaccine, I got vaccinated, and I got the flu anyway, what health departments usually say in response is, probably you were already incubating the flu when you got vaccinated. You got vaccinated only a couple of weeks ago and you had the flu already. Or they say, probably you didn't have the flu. You had some flu-like illness. And the flu vaccine doesn't protect against all flu-like illnesses. It only protects against things that are genuinely influenza. Those are the things they tell you when you say, I got vaccinated and I got the flu anyway. What they don't tell you is it's only 70 to 90% effective in healthy adults. And there's a pretty good chance that, you know, 1 year in three or 1 year in four or 1 year in five, your vaccine didn't take. And you're just as vulnerable to the flu as if you hadn't been vaccinated. They don't want you to know that. Again, they don't hide it. They just don't emphasize it. Now, are you with me so far?
I'm with you.
That 70 to 90% is in healthy adults. Okay? And they often say that. They often don't say that. What they very, very rarely say is it's a lot lower than that in the elderly. In the elderly, it's thought to be around 50% effective, the flu vaccine. So, you roughly half the elderly people who get vaccinated, they might as well not have been vaccinated. It didn't do them any good. They don't tell you that, and the reason they don't tell you that is because they particularly want elderly people to get vaccinated, because elderly people are the most vulnerable to the flu. 90% of flu deaths are people over 65. Most of those 90% are over 75. A lot of them are over 85. Flu is predominantly deadly to people who are very old and very sick. They don't tell you that because they want young people to get vaccinated. And they don't tell you that the people most in danger of dying from the flu are precisely the people least likely to be helped by getting vaccinated. They want young people to get vaccinated, so they don't say flu is mostly deadly to the elderly. They want the elderly to get vaccinated, so they don't say the vaccine is relatively ineffective in elderly vaccinees. The public health profession is much more interested now than it used to be in years past in vaccinating young children. We're moving toward universal vaccination and or trying to move toward universal vaccination for flu. There's much more emphasis than there used to be on vaccinating young children. Well, the flu vaccine, you know, most of the evidence suggests, is less effective on young children than it is on healthy adults. They don't want to tell you that either, because, you know, they want to persuade parents to take their two-year-olds to get vaccinated, and they don't want to talk about the efficacy of the vaccine among two-year-olds. None of these are safety issues, and none of these, in my judgment, you know, mean that some group of people shouldn't get vaccinated against the flu. The fact that flu is not as effective as we imagine it is, the fact that you know some years we really don't need the vaccine because we had it last year and it's the same vaccine. Some years it's a bad match and it won't work as well as it usually does. If you're elderly, it doesn't work as well as it usually does. If you're a young child, it doesn't work as well as it does on healthy adults. If you're not healthy, it doesn't work as well as it does on healthy adults. This is a vaccine that works best on people who don't need it and works least well on people who need it most. All of that doesn't mean you shouldn't get vaccinated. It means it's not as great a vaccine as we all wish it were. But it's all information that public health at a high level consciously decides to leave out of the message. And public health at a lower level, when we're talking about local health officers, or individual doctors, it gets left out because they just don't know it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are at least three very good reasons for trying to get as many people vaccinated as possible. One is, being sick as a dog for a week is not good for you. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for anybody to have lots of people home from school or home from work sick as a dog. So even if you're not going to die, even if the mortality rate were zero, it would be worth getting vaccinated. So that's one. Two is, the people on whom the vaccine works best, healthy adults, are people who are otherwise likely to spread the disease, even if it isn't going to kill them. It may well kill their grandparents. It may well kill their immunocompromised friend. So in order to save the lives of the most vulnerable people, it's a good idea to get everybody vaccinated if you can. And the third reason is that each year we make, the pharmaceutical industry manufactures as many doses of vaccine as roughly were sold last year. So if you want to sustain the market and build the market and build the manufacturing capacity so that, for example, when there's a pandemic, you have enough manufacturing capacity, or at least you're never going to have enough, but you have more manufacturing capacity than you otherwise would, the more people get vaccinated this year, the more vaccine we will have when we need it most. Those are all three good reasons for urging people to get vaccinated. But in my judgment, they're not good reasons for dishonestly urging people to get vaccinated. And what happens is public health people are very attuned to how valuable it is to get people vaccinated. And they're insufficiently attuned to how damaging it is to tell half-truths or even 95% truths.